Welcome, friends, to Economic Update, a weekly program devoted to the economic dimensions of our lives, our jobs, our incomes, our debts. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been an economics professor all of my adult life, and now I work hard on this program to bring economic analysis down to where it's understandable and up to where it can be an important part of your daily life and of the way you shape the society that we live in. I'll have more to say later in the program about the websites we maintain and the way you can follow us in an ongoing way, but I want to jump right in today to our updates, our short items that we begin each program with. Then I respond to questions that you have sent in through our websites. And finally, in the second half of today's program, we're going to have a very interesting interview with my guest talking about the economics of housing in the United States, past and present. So let's jump right in. My eye was caught this last week by pizza. No, not pizza to eat it, but pizza to understand an interesting phenomenon. The fact that jumped out at me was the following. That according to Paul Krugman in the New York Times, the Pizza Hut chain, one of the largest purveyors of pizza in the United States, gives 99% of the considerable amount of money it gives to politicians to the Republican Party. That's how it's decided to distribute its wealth. 99% of its contributions go to the Republican Party, 1% go to the Democratic Party. I should be clear, other pizza producers distribute their money differently between the two major parties. What I'm interested in is why? Why would a pizza parlor, even a chain of pizza parlors, be so interested in giving significant amounts of money to our politicians? Well, the answer turns out to be pretty clear. The pizza companies are worried about all the concern that might exist in our society about healthy eating. See, it turns out that pizza is not the most healthy of foods. You can do better than pizza, as you can do better than many snack foods in the United States. And there's even people who think that pizza has something to do with obesity, the national problem about overweight, with diabetes, an absolute epidemic, particularly in the South and other parts of the United States. And so groups have gotten together to suggest that while, of course, everybody should be and can be free to buy whatever food they wish, that in cases where you're required to make a decision for people unable to choose their own diets wisely, that a diet should be chosen that does not emphasize unhealthy food. Make a long story short. The schools. Across America, there are children in schools who eat meals prepared in and by the school systems. Question: should pizza be a major or indeed any kind of part of that kind of a diet? Or is it important in school to establish for children healthy eating habits, proper, healthy, scientifically chosen diets? The pizza companies are afraid that one of the ways you get people to buy pizza when they're adults is to make sure they get a steady dose of it when they're kids. And they're not pleased with politicians who want to mandate healthy diets based on science rather than, get ready for this, allowing people the freedom to choose their own food. So that's how the issue gets posed by the pizza companies. Freedom versus slavery. Are you going to be, ready, slave of a scientist, of a dietitian when you're a child, or are you going to be free? It's hard to take this very seriously, and yet the issues are enormous. And here comes the economics. We, the taxpayers of America, are required to fork over huge amounts of tax money to take care of illnesses that are epidemics in our society, and major ones among them, yep, diabetes and obesity. So it turns out we all have a stake in what kind of diet is given to our children in particular, but to all of us on top of that. It isn't just a personal choice, because we are required by law to pay the medical bills of people who, quote unquote, choose to eat a particular kind of diet. It is important, therefore, to understand the way our economy works. There are no big corporations that are behind healthy eating. The ones that are possible typically are too small, and they can't begin to compete for resources with the giants in the food industry, who are mostly the producers of, let's be polite now, not so healthy food. Food made up mostly of salt and sugar and fat. And the result is that there's an imbalance in our free enterprise economy between the money devoted to getting us to eat bad food that's profitable versus the money that's devoted to getting us to eat good and healthy food, which hasn't got behind it the profit-making machines that have developed in the fast food industry. And the people who are behind those profits use them to buy the political support to keep us suffering as a nation from diabetes, from obesity, and from the enormous tax bill to help the people who suffer from those diseases, in part because they didn't have the kind of healthy diet in their schools that might otherwise have been achieved. Let me turn next to a topic that is even more important and more timely in terms of what's going on today. Over the last week, a dramatic change in the value of currencies in the world has accelerated. I am talking about the drop in the value of the euro, the most important currency in the world after the dollar, and the dollar. Basically, the euro has lost value, approximately 40% of its value, or nearly so, since the middle of last year, 2014. It took a major dive this last week and is now approaching what is called parity, 1 euro equaling roughly $1. So far, it's a little more than a dollar, but that's way less than the $1.40 it took to get a euro 6 months ago. What does that mean, that the dollar is stronger relative to the euro? Well, there are two things it means among many consequences. There are two that bode poorly for the American economy in the months and years ahead. And I want to alert you, my listeners and viewers, to this reality. First, this is going to hurt exports. Those Americans whose jobs depend on the ability of their employer to sell goods and services abroad are now facing a situation that American products are much more expensive in Europe than they used to be. And Europe is a major market for American exports. Why? Well, as little as 6 months ago, for 1 euro that a European had to pay, he or she got $1.40 worth of U.S. stuff. 1 euro got you $1.40. Today, 1 euro barely gets you a dollar, which means that in terms of euros, you got to give up much more than you did 6 months ago to buy the same quantity of American stuff. The same number of dollars now cost you way more euros than before because your euro has lost value. That's going to hurt the export of American goods and services to Europe, and that is going to lead to fewer people being hired, to less profits being earned by American export companies, fewer taxes paid by them, you get the picture. But there's a second and equally important situation. When the euro drops in value, it's very good news for Americans who want to buy things in Europe. Why? Well, same logic as before. 6 months ago, you had to give up $1.40 to get the euro to buy something in Europe. Today, you only have to give up a dollar to get the euro to buy something. So for us, anything priced in euros is much cheaper in the United States now than it was before, a lot cheaper. This means an opportunity for American companies to buy companies in Europe because it's much, much cheaper. So an American company that before decided not to close its factory in Cincinnati or to close its factory in Richmond, California or in Texas, now will close its factory because this is the moment to buy maybe a competitor in Poland or in Italy or in Belgium, because you can do it at so much of a lower cost in dollars. And that will be an incentive for American companies to move production abroad. This is a good moment to consider that kind of move. And that's not good for American jobs and American income. We have a quote-unquote recovery that is very weak, that has only benefited the top 10 or 15% of our people, and it is now in danger that the rising value of the dollar and the falling value of the euro will lead to cuts in exports and the movement of production abroad, and that's a serious matter, and the more the euro falls, the more pronounced these effects will be. My third short update for today has to do with a perennial problem, but it's gearing up now in preparation for the election in 2016, the presidential election. This last week, several Republican senators trying to become the Republican candidate for president, and here I'm talking particularly of Marco Rubio from Florida, Mike Lee from Utah, and Rand Paul from Kentucky, have each announced their commitment to massive tax cuts. Okay? They believe that massive tax cuts are the way to get our economy going again. And I want to talk to you a little bit about this. I don't mean to pick on Republicans. I will admit that I'm not much held back from doing that, but it's not that I mean to single them out. There are Democrats who say the same sort of thing. So let's examine it on today's analysis of what's going on. Here's the theory that these people put forward, and I'm being really generous by calling it a theory. Other words come to mind, but I'm a polite person, and I won't go there. The theory goes like this. If we cut taxes, we leave a lot more money in the hands of individuals and in the hands of corporations. Step two of the theory then says, these corporations and individuals, happy to no longer be paying the taxes they did before, will go out and do what we want individuals and corporations to do. The individuals will spend the money, and the corporations will invest the money that they have saved from the reduced taxes. And then we'll all be better off as the companies create jobs and the people spending the money they've saved in taxes create demand, and the economy will boom. In other words, by cutting taxes, we'll produce an economic growth spurt that will trickle down and help everybody. By the way, I use the word trickle down because this is a kind of trickle down economics. You help a particular group, and then you assert that doing that means that the benefits will trickle down to everybody. How nice. You promise that everybody will be better off from your act of helping a particular group. Well, when you look at the proposals put forward by Senators Rubio, Lee, and Rand Paul, it turns out that the vast bulk of their tax cuts benefit corporations and the rich. They want to cut capital gains tax. They want to cut estate tax. They want to cut the corporate tax rate from 35 to 25%, and so on. So it really is trickle-down economics. You're proposing a tax cut that mostly helps corporations and the rich, To sweeten it and make the mass of people go along, you give them a little bit too. The proposals of Rubio and Lee reduce the top rate of the income tax from 39% down to 35% or 36%. Not very big and not going to help the mass of people very much at all. But you hope they won't notice that they'll be so happy to get any kind of economic relief that even a modest tax relief will get the mass of people in America to go along with what is in fact a tremendous tax cut for corporations and the rich. And the theory again is, by helping corporations and the rich, the benefits will trickle down from them to all the rest of us. If you study this, you know that most of the time, the trickle-down that's promised never materializes. The beneficiaries are those who get a tax cut. It turns out they can use that money any way they wish. You cut taxes on a corporation, that doesn't mean it's going to go invest more of that money. That's a free enterprise decision. They may take their tax cut money, the money they don't pay in taxes after a tax cut, and invest it abroad. Or not invest it at all, or use it to lend to the United States government, or to another government. They're free to do any of those things, and those things will not trickle down to the average American. And ditto, even a little bit of tax cut on the mass of people may not be spent by them. They may pay down the debts they can hardly carry anymore with the money they save in taxes, and that means they won't be buying more goods and services, will they? In other words, there's no necessity, no guarantee that a tax cut trickles down to anybody. And many times in the past, these tax cuts have trickled down to nobody. They haven't trickled at all. So here's what these tax cuts are really about. They're not about a program to develop the economy or to grow the economy. That's just the political cover, the public relations veneer. Over something else. And what's the something else? It's pandering. It is the decision of politicians that the way forward in their careers is to pander to where the money is. Promise tax cuts to the rich and to corporations, and they will reward you by contributions to your party, by contributions to your next campaign, by celebrating you as a great political leader. That's what the purpose is. That's what the reward is, and the rest is lots of BS with economic theories that are a shame to hear coming from these people's mouths. At this part of the program, I respond to questions that you have sent in based on things we have covered in the past or things you have found out in our websites that I promised to tell you about a little bit later in the program. So let's turn now to a response. The first question, and it's actually a group of questions that you send in to me from time to time, refers to a topic you know we cover a lot here, worker co-ops, or what we like to call worker self-directed enterprises. And your questions go to the following. Will worker co-ops, two kinds of questions that I'm going to deal with today, will worker co-ops mean that everybody gets paid the same amount of money? A lot of you asked that question, and even more of you asked the following question. How can we expect worker co-ops to become a real part of this economy, a real option for people to buy from and to work in, alongside choosing a more conventional, traditional capitalist enterprise? How can that happen? Because won't worker co-ops be at a competitive disadvantage with capitalist enterprises? In other words, for example, you ask, a capitalist enterprise, the executive can make a quick decision. In a worker co-op, the workers will have to discuss it. It's a democratic process. It takes time. Won't that put you at a competitive disadvantage? Others of you put it this way. In a competitive enterprise, if you have more workers than you need, you fire them. End of story. But in a worker-run enterprise, won't there be a lot of obstacles and hesitancy of workers to damage the lives of their fellow workers by voting to fire? And how will they even get that done? Who loses their job? Who keeps it? And so on. So let me respond to both. First, the vast majority of co-ops, worker co-ops in the world, pay their workers different amounts of money. So the answer, the simple answer to the question, do worker co-ops necessarily pay everybody the same? The answer is no, most of them don't. Some do, and some of those who do will give you very interesting arguments about why that has been a very successful strategy for them and a way of holding everybody together and making for a much more cohesive enterprise. But the reality is many co-ops decide that some kinds of work should be paid at a higher rate than others, depending on the difficulty of the work, the unpleasantness of the work, the amount of training and education and skill you took to acquire it, and the expenses of getting that training. So the typical worker co-op allows for quite a range of payment. To use the most famous example in the world, the Mondragon Corporation in the north of Spain, with over 100,000 workers, they have a rule that they have abided by for quite some years, that the highest paid person cannot get more than about 8.5 times what the lowest paid person does. Just to give you an idea, in an American large corporation, the CEO will very often get 200 to 300 times the amount of pay of the lowest paid worker. So it's a much narrower range of difference, but it's still a considerable range of difference that worker co-ops have chosen to use. Second, about competitiveness. Let me be very clear, because this is a question many of you send to us. There are ways in which capitalist corporations are more competitive than worker co-ops, but those are balanced by ways in which worker co-ops are more competitive than capitalist enterprises. And the net result is there's no necessity for either one to outcompete the other. And again, the Mondragon Corporation offers a very useful empirical proof. Mondragon began in 1956 in Spain with 6 workers forming a co-op under the direction of a Roman Catholic priest in that part of Spain. Now, fast forward 70 years later, almost, and we have 100,000 workers. In order to get from 6 workers to 100,000, the Mondragon Corporation, a worker co-op with kinds of rules of the sort I just described, had to compete against literally hundreds of capitalist enterprises across the way. Mondragon, by the way, is a family of 250 co-ops. Every one of those co-ops has had to compete in its lifetime against capitalist enterprises doing similar things. Bottom line, the Mondragon Corporation won in those competitive struggles. That's why it grew. It successfully competed against all manner of capitalist corporations. So that answers the question, can a worker co-op compete against a capitalist enterprise? We know the answer because the history of Spain proves it. But let me give you the reasons why. In most worker co-ops, the workers not only do the work and control the work and direct the work, but they also own the company. That is, these are enterprises where the workers are the owners as well as the directors of the enterprise. You don't have to be both, but in many co-ops, that's the way it is. And then they don't have to give dividends to some other group of people. They don't have to charge enough money for what they sell to pay not only their wages, to pay not only the costs of doing business, but also to pay dividends to owners. They don't need to do that. So they can lower their price to outcompete another company that's a capitalist company whose prices have to allow them to pay off dividends to their shareholders. That gives them a competitive advantage. Number two, they don't have high-priced executives because the workers collectively direct their own enterprise. They pay themselves for the directorial, the managerial activity, and they don't pay spectacular high salaries to the CEO, etc. That saves them money, which allows them to price more competitively against a capitalist enterprise that does make those kinds of payments. Let me give you a couple of more examples. A worker who simply comes to work 5 days a week, 9 to 5, and feels no relationship to the people who run the factory, who run the office, he has, or she has, less of a commitment to that enterprise because they don't own it. Less of a commitment because they don't direct it. less of a commitment because they don't feel valued the way they would be if they were given responsibility and authority of directing their own enterprise. And that translates into not caring all that much about what happens. You see something going on that's not efficient, that's not effective. If you own the business, you pay attention. If you don't own the business, let's be nice, you pay less attention. A worker-owned and operated enterprise, every worker in there knows that his or her well-being depends on the success of that company. They are the ones in charge, and their attitude is the attitude you would expect from somebody who owns the enterprise, from someone who's a director of the enterprise, and not from someone who's just paid a sum of money and told what to do. That works out to the advantage of a worker-directed enterprise. Last thing. Every enterprise that has capitalists, board of directors, shareholders on the one hand, and workers on the other, is terribly affected by what used to be called class struggle, or the conflict between workers and managers, or the conflict between owners and workers. That kind of struggle disappears when the same people are the managers and owners on the one hand and the workers on the other. They don't struggle with themselves. They don't have that kind of conflict in the core of the production system, and that makes them more efficient as well. Okay, folks, I was going to go into one more. Well, let me snatch an extra minute here. Question. Do we have a free market in agricultural production in the United States? The simple answer is no, and we haven't had one for well over a century. Huge amounts of protection and subsidies and benefits go to corn and wheat and sorghum and sugar. We do all kinds of things, and we have as a nation for a long time. The very politicians who talk about free markets are often the same ones who vote the laws that protect American agriculture from competition in the world. That's why the price of sugar in this country is much higher than the price of sugar everywhere else in the world. We protect sugar producers. That's why we give all kinds of subsidies to huge corn companies and huge wheat and sorghum companies to help them. We think as a nation we ought to do that. I'm not disputing whether we ought to or not. I just want you to understand it's a stunning example of how and why the free market has nothing to do with the reality of agricultural capitalism in the United States today. We've come to the end of the first half of our program. This is Richard Wolff. This is Economic Update. And I'd like to invite you, please, to stay with us. We will have a short break, as we always do. Then I will return with our guest, Walter South, and our topic for the interview in the second half of the program, the housing industry in the United States, where it's been, where it is now, and where you fit in it, and in the future it portends for us all. Be right back. Please stay with us. Welcome back to Economic Update. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. In this second half of the program, we're going to be talking about the economics of housing in the United States. My guest is Walter South. So before I even introduce him, let me welcome you to the program, Walter, and thank you for giving me some of your time. Okay, let me tell you about Walter South. He has been in school too long, in many universities. Started out at Indiana University, then went to the New School for Social Research in New York, Hunter College, Pratt Institute, the Milano School at the New School in New York. He studied urban planning, urban policy, historic preservation, sociology. This is a person with a great deal of education in this area of housing and of public policy around housing. He has also taught at the Rutgers Law School in New Jersey, at Richmond College in the City University of New York, at New York University's Real Estate Institute, and so on. He has gotten foundation grants to study housing in both New York and New Jersey. He has himself, together with others, developed housing projects, improved and renovated housing projects. This is a person with a long history of involvement in housing, with a particular interest in producing affordable housing. So, Walter, thank you not only for being here, but for bringing this background and this expertise. So let me start with a question that often comes to me in this program and in the work that I do. How much money should the housing that every American, or indeed anyone listening to this program anywhere in the world, spends? In other words, housing is a basic human need. It's like food, it's like clothing, it's the shelter without which we can't be healthy and we can't live our lives. Tell us a little bit, help my listeners and my viewers understand, how much should housing take out of the incomes we have? How much does it take? How do we compare with other parts of the world?
Well, actually, the figure is completely arbitrary. We used to, in this country, housing used to be about 25% of family income was considered to be normal. But in 1981, Congress raised that rate for public housing to 30%, and 30% became the normal figure for this country. But this is a figure which is just basically picked out of the sky. There's no rationale for it. If you look at other countries, you find that, for example, Swedes only pay 26% of their income for housing, and the Danes only pay 27%, and the Slovaks only pay 25%, and in the EU, it's only 22%. So obviously, this figure of 30% is higher than practically any other country in the world. I mean, in the Western
developed world.
Yeah, right.
So to say this in another way, just to make sure I understand, you're saying that when the government uses and it becomes the norm that 30% of your income is what you ought to expect to have to pay for your housing, that puts us already in a different place from, say, the Europeans,
exactly,
who pay a significantly lower share of their incomes for their housing.
That's exactly right. And what's happening is, so because rents have been going up, for example, New York City, the Post this week reported that the median rent in New York City is $2,700, which is more
per
than
month.
Per month, which is 58% of what the residents earn. So
wow.
58% of the residents in New York City today, theoretically, can't afford the rents, their market rent.
So, again, to be real clear, the standard that the government uses is 30%, but the reality of the housing market in the United States
in New York
means that in
yep.
New York City,
no.
And I don't think New York City is all that different from a lot of other places, but in New York City, we're almost double that. 58% of the income, of the average income, is being used for the average apartment, means that we are basically putting Americans in a position where they have relatively much, much less to spend on everything else in life if something as basic as housing requires that much.
Well, it's a little bit more interesting than that. There's a group in Chicago, the CNT, and they did a study of 21 of the largest metropolitan areas in the country. And in their study, they combined housing costs with transportation costs. Because after all, if you do live like in the suburbs, you have to have a car, at least one car, and maybe three.
In other words, it's better to put those two together than to
separate. Right. You can't really separate them. And what they found out is that the average in 21 metropolitan areas, the average were paying 48% for their housing and for transportation.
In other words, half in 21 metropolitan areas, basically half of the income that people were earning was necessary for their home, their car, or whatever other transportation they used. Amazing.
And interestingly enough, that doesn't count their mortgage. If you count their mortgage, it's 72%.
Wow.
So the question of affordability is not a question for New York City. It's a question for the whole country.
All right. So we have the bottom line here is that we have a housing economy which is burdening our people to an extraordinary extent.
Right.
Even by the standard of the United States government and by comparison with Europe.
Yes.
Okay. Well, let's move on. We have a very peculiar housing structure in the United system. Once upon a time, we were an agrarian, a farming country, and we all lived all over the place in the rural areas. But for a century or more now, actually at least a century and a half now, we have concentrated our people in two places. Off of the rural areas, a tiny number of our people now live in the rural areas or engage in farming. The vast majority of our people either live in a city or live in an immediately around the city in what we've come to call the suburbs.
Suburbs, right.
Tell us a little bit about how that particular way of organizing our living arrangements, how that happened in the United States.
Well, housing developed in the United States quite differently from Europe. In the United States, the one thing that we always had was more space. So
yes, we're a big country,
yeah,
and
right.
There are lots of little ones.
So if you look at our history, when the Puritans came here originally, they came here because they wanted to take advantage of the space, right? They didn't come here because they were Democrats. They came here because they wanted independence. There's a difference.
Yes.
Matter of fact, they were so grossly against anything other than what they thought the church was that they even kicked out a group that had to go to Rhode Island, right? So what happened in this country is if you wanted to have 40 wives, for example, or you didn't want your daughter to date an Irish Catholic guy, you moved out.
Yes.
And they did.
And there was space for you to go to.
Always have been space, right. And of course, part of the reason that this has happened is that the states have the right to determine municipality rather than the federal government. So as a consequence, if you've moved out and formed a little town of your own, then you went to the state and you set up your own government. So
it allowed all the different groups to get together with
right.
others that they approved of
right.
to exclude those they didn't.
Exactly.
So you produced cities and towns that had an exclusionary arrangement. There was no larger planning process. It just happened according to who had the money and the political connections to make this happen.
If you look at what's happening today, we have 89,500 local governments. And there are 19,492 municipalities, 16,500 townships, 13,000 school districts, and 37,000 other districts.
Yeah, in other words, it's an incredible patchwork of different administrative systems that people can choose among in terms of where they live, and with the result that you get certain kinds of patterns. What are the patterns that have actually happened in the United States out of this arrangement?
Well, I think if you look at St. Louis, for example, they have about 60 municipalities outside the city within the...
How many?
60.
60.
In the metropolitan area. And, of course, Detroit is probably the best example. Detroit has been gutted primarily because of suburbanization that's taken place outside the city. Matter of fact, in Detroit, there's actually a suburb in the city because the GM wanted to have their own district within the greater metropolitan area of Detroit. So Detroit is actually a very good example of people being sucked out of the city into the suburbs. Because the suburbs, if you had mostly rich people living in that suburb, you could levy taxes and you could have a good school system. You didn't have to put up with the school system downtown. And so that's exactly what happened.
So people over the last, I think particularly since the Second World War, there's a pattern of people unhappy with whatever the conditions were in the cities, having an option of leaving the city and going to a suburb that could exclude everybody who wasn't rich by zoning rules that said you have to have an acre or two per house.
Or no apartments.
Or no apartments right. to be built at all. In other words, you allowed people in different economic groups to move into an area which became exclusive for them and that could block others from coming.
And segregation has worked very well.
Do you mean segregation by race? Do you mean segregation by economics?
I think we live in a country in which talking about segregation about race is acceptable, but talking about segregation by economics is not acceptable. I think the bottom line is basically it's economics.
And tell us a little bit, you know, embellish that. Tell me.
Well, there are a couple of things that you need to know, I mean, which has helped this problem. One of them is in 1938, the federal government set up a mortgage in Washington, and they would insure mortgages for the local banks. And as a result of this, they standardized the type of mortgage that you could get, a 30-year self-amortized mortgage. At a fixed interest rate. And of course, a lot of the areas took advantage of this mortgage. The only thing was the mortgage was not, you couldn't get a mortgage if you were black or Jewish, and probably for a while even Irish, because they felt that that would decrease the value of the mortgage. So large segments of the country were redlined by the Homeowners Loan Corporation. And these red lines were followed by most of the banks in this country.
So in other words, the government guaranteed the mortgage so that the banks no longer had a risk.
Right.
And the banks would be willing to lend. But in order to make it all work, they had rules, these banks did. They didn't lend to poor people, basically. And they didn't lend to
minorities
of various kinds that they didn't approve of or they didn't think were. And so you ended up again through this program creating these economically segregated suburb versus city, upper income suburb versus less income suburb, this pattern that we now see. And I notice you picked St. Louis. I know from talking to you that one of the reasons is something that's in the news this week, Ferguson. Mm-hmm. Because in a sense, the explosion of Ferguson, the shooting of a black person by a white police officer, and now this latest week of more troubles and more tension, suggests that your thesis that this isn't just a racial problem, although it clearly has that dimension, but is also an economic problem. Tell us a little bit more about how Ferguson reflects and shows what you've been telling
us. Well, I think you have to understand that what happened after the Second World War is we had this interstate highway program. And Ferguson actually was one of the first, what we call trolley car suburbs. It was the location of the train station, the first stop outside of St. Louis. And so when it was set up, the guy who owned the land, Mr. Ferguson, gave 10 acres to the rail company, and they put the rail line through his property and a station. So white people moved out there. But after the Second World War, the interstate highway program developed. And this, in turn, opened up even more space, which we had plenty of, right? Next suburb to Ferguson actually was a very famous golf course. And this golf course decided to move further out on the interstates. And as a result, the people who lived in Ferguson moved out to play golf. And not only that, the county, the municipality wanted to build out Logan Airport. And as a result, the runway just happened to go right into a black community. So the black community was displaced for the new Logan Airport expansion.
This is for St. Louis.
Yeah, and they moved into, guess where? Ferguson. Because now whites are moving out of Ferguson. So the blacks
are moving further out with the interstate.
Right.
And the displaced African-American community moves to Ferguson.
Right. And of course, another thing was a lot of these areas outside of the city had restrictive covenants. A restrictive covenant says that you can't do X. Like you can't sell the black guy, you can't sell the Jew, you can't have an outhouse, you can't live in a house trailer. So until these were thrown out in a court case in Missouri, most of these areas were restricted and blacks had to move into areas like eventually Ferguson.
So you had to have the money to move, you had to have the money to qualify for a mortgage, and then you had to be whatever they were allowed by their covenants to sell to.
Right.
So you created black-dominated communities where a disproportionate number of blacks could live and other communities where they were blocked from living.
Right, exactly.
And the same is true for poor people or Jews or Irish or whoever was being excluded by this patchwork arrangement that was not subject to any overarching logic or regional planning or sense of how... Well, you know, let me pose you then the question that I'm sure is in the minds of many of those listening, which is, if you believe in a democratic system of everybody equal, then you would have to have a housing structure consistent with that. What you're describing is a country that says it's committed to democracy, but is in fact permitting and even encouraging the structure of housing in cities that is contrary to democratic everything.
Exactly.
And then wonders why the democracy is formal and not real.
Matter of fact, after the Second World War, we had this guy by the name of Levitt. You may have heard of him.
Yes.
And he started building housing outside
Levittowns.
Levittowns, right. He was selling for $6,900 an 800-square-foot house. And you could move in.
This was right after World War II?
Right. You could move in for $60 a month. And as a result, if you're white. And as
that
a result,
was a rule.
Yeah.
If you weren't white, you couldn't.
Right. You couldn't get a mortgage. You couldn't get
so
mortgage.
So effectively, you're excluded.
Right.
So you had to have that amount of money to spend.
You had to have
white.
$60.
Yeah. Well, I mean, sounds like very little now, but $60 in 1947 was significant money.
Yeah, but you had the GI
Bill.
Were coming back, and they could go to college, and so $60 was a reasonable price a month for a house. Yeah, and of course, what happened between 1900 and 1960, the suburbs boomed. So for the 50 years from 1950 to 2000, the suburbs grew at an alarming rate. And then when the suburbs, when they grew, of course, they needed a place to shop. So the shopping malls grew along with them, and strip shopping also moved in at the same time.
And I remember one of the side results that if we had more time, we would talk about it. One of the consequences of all of this was that the cities lost population.
Right.
The cities deteriorated. And instead of that being understood as a problem that required the nation to come to terms with it, what you had was the private solution of individuals. If the city is becoming a problem, I personally, with my family, I'm leaving the city. I'm going to a better, safer, cheaper suburb. And so you had the city's deterioration continue. The government efforts were never enough to counter the private enterprise decisions of masses of people to leave. And then the stores followed them.
Yeah.
And then you had this absurdity. I remember for years I lived in New Haven, Connecticut, which was constantly redeveloping and revitalizing its downtown because it couldn't face the reality that the people in the suburbs were never going to come back into town to shop because the shopping centers had moved out to where they were and people were unwilling or afraid to come into the city. So the deterioration, the gap between city and suburb, which is replicated in our national politics, has gotten worse and worse. And places like St. Louis, Detroit, Cleveland, Camden are the kind of exemplary cases of the extremity of this inequality.
Yeah, if you look at Ferguson, for example, in 1900, they only had 1,000 people living in the town, but by 1960, the town had grown to about 22,000, and it's stayed pretty much around that figure since then. But the racial balance has changed. In 2000, 4% were white, and 52% were African American. In 2010, only 29% were white, and 67% were African American. So what happened is, you have a community like this, and of course you have to have a mayor, you have to have a city council, and you have to have a school system, and you have to have a superintendent of schools, and you have to have a court system, and you have to have police. So this costs a lot of money. And since in the case of Ferguson, since the voting for these offices took place in off years, in other words, not when the presidential election took place, but in the off years, as a consequence, the whites were pretty much able to hold on to power here, and the blacks were pretty much excluded.
Yes, I think in the news reporting about Ferguson, one of the most stunning realities was that you basically had a white government and a white police force policing an overwhelmingly majority African-American community and acting as if this was reasonable, normal, and then the surprise and shock when it blows up on you.
Well, it blew up because Ferguson, actually, I think about 40% of Ferguson today, the housing is underwater. And as a result, the town needed income. So they told the cops, go out there and arrest everybody you can. And I think in Ferguson alone, right in the last few years, they've been issuing like 1,500 tickets for every 1,000 people that live in the town.
Yeah, it's incredible. A town that not only funds itself by parking tickets and driving tickets
and
pedestrians,
right,
but does so in this grossly unfair way to sustain an army of public officials, which a regional structure would save vast amounts of money by consolidating, and then has a white apparatus imposing this on a black population. I mean, you couldn't design a more dysfunctional explosive system if you sat down and worked at it. I think
what's happening in Ferguson is very interesting because nobody's really asking the right question. The right question is, do we need Ferguson?
Right. Do we need towns
up
like this
with
this kind of lopsided government expense imposed on a minority? I mean, it is beyond words. The answer is obviously yes, and in fact, it only leads to the question, how in the world is this allowed to become this way? In the minute we have left for this, you said something to me before we went on the air that I want you to say again. Is Ferguson an extreme example of something that we don't have to worry about because it doesn't occur a lot? Or is Ferguson average? Or how do we assess the craziness of Ferguson within the larger problems of our housing industry?
Well, take a look at the New York Times Sunday, the 8th?
8th of March.
8th of March. You'll find that Ferguson was probably the least of the problems in both the St. Louis metropolitan area and Kansas City metropolitan area. And there was a conference, apparently, of the police, and the police were surprised that Ferguson blew up because there are other areas in that area
that are worse examples.
Much, much, much worse.
All right. Would you, last point that we'll have time for, do you think the problems of housing and Ferguson and suburbanization, given what you just said, are we looking at an abnormal situation, or are we looking at explosions that every logic would lead us to expect will multiply and worsen in these other examples that are worse than Ferguson?
I think it's likely that Ferguson is going showing what the future might hold for us. But I also think that there's a possibility that if we set up like limited equity co-ops in our cities that were green, we could start addressing a lot of these problems.
Right. The initiative, and I know you're working on that, and maps when you come back to us in a future time, can talk about setting up both a community structure, a regional structure, and a housing that, because they're all so interconnected, as you've shown us, would allow us to have more a democratic system, but a more viable way for our people to interact with one another rather than in this chaotic and, as we now see, explosive, allowing all of this to happen in a way that disrupts the peace, the tranquility, and the proper relationship among people.
I think there's even a bigger problem, and that's climate change. Climate change has made practically all these areas completely unsustainable. And unless we change where we live and how we live and who we live with, we're going to have problems.
All right. Thank you very much, Walter.
Thank you.
I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you. Housing is a problem that is fundamental to our economic system. As we draw to a close, I want to tell you, as I've promised you, something about the websites we maintain. Economic Update is a weekly program, but everything you hear and see on this program is elaborated on our two websites, rdwolf2fs.com and Democracy at Work, one word, democracyatwork.info, I-N-F-O. Please make use of these websites to learn more, to pursue your interests, to see the kinds of work we do, which is only in a small way featured on this program every week. Also, those websites will allow you to do a number of other things. To communicate with us, there's an email function on both websites that allows you to send us questions, comments, criticisms. We read and study everything you send to us and use it to shape how this program evolves, who we invite for interviews, and so on. Also, both websites allow you, by clicking on an icon, to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. And in that moment, when you might think of doing that, please also think of telling other people about this program, about what you might have learned that was interesting. Draw their attention, perhaps, to the fact that all of our programs are archived on those websites. You can find every week's program available for you to listen to at that time. I also want to thank Truthout, that remarkable independent source of news and analysis every day that carries my work and that distributes this program, truthout.org. It's a website worth your time to take a look at. Finally, if you are interested in this program or in having me come to wherever you find this program on the air, please know that we make many trips during the year. I would be more than interested to come to the area you're involved in to speak, particularly if we can do some joint fundraising as part of that. Please get in touch with us through the websites to arrange that kind of thing as well. Thank you very much for being with us this week on Economic Update. I'm your host, Richard Wolf, and I look forward to being with you again next week.